So I'm surprising you with this, but I made
Oh
an
no.
intro theme,
Okay, I figured you would.
which is terrible and like it's totally not usable, but we're probably gonna play it anyway. So I'm gonna make you listen to it.
Gonna make me listen to it. That's like show tunes. Show tunes. How long is this?
It's not that. Not that long. It's a few seconds.
30 seconds.
Is it?
Yes.
Yes.
Might actually be long. Okay. No, is it?
Yeah, I don't know. I was playing around.
Why don't we just speed up the whole podcast and make that the intro?
Oh, perfect.
So speed it up to like 5 seconds or 3 seconds and then just play that at the beginning?
Well, because there are a lot of podcasts where they do like the, you know, coming up on TMS, the, you know, this topic, and this topic, and then they do the thing. If we just sped up the entire podcast and played it in the space of 30
yes.
seconds, you'd know exactly what you're in for.
All right. We should save this banter for the real podcast.
Okay, so yeah, we've got a list of various subjects that we want to talk about, but I want to ask you kind of first off about The Martian, because that's timely, which I guess means we also have to like edit and release this podcast in a somewhat timely fashion. But what were your thoughts on The Martian?
Okay, I should preface this by saying I am a horrible movie critic in that I like most movies that I watch.
Mm.
I have the ability to not get so lost in plot holes or stuff that they ruin the movie for me.
Mm.
So having said that, I really enjoyed The Martian. I agree with most of the critics that actually can disagree with liking a, can dislike a movie. Yes. And I know you haven't watched it.
No, I haven't. Well, actually, now I'm curious. The caveat that you had to throw in there, is that because there are a bunch of plot holes that would otherwise ruin the movie for most people?
No. There are not huge plot holes. I'm just trying to think. Like, there was most of it was particularly sound. I mean, there were some questionable decisions, but you could always put that down to everyone is super stressed and they decided to do that because it was the first thing that worked, even though there was a much simpler thing they could have done.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I suppose we should say, are we doing spoilers or no?
No, I think we should probably not do spoilers because...
Okay. Then I won't.
I mean, it did gross a ton of money, so presumably everyone has already seen it. But I don't know, for that one or two people...
Kevin, you realize like only one or two people are listening.
Well, yeah, okay, that's fair.
That's a fairly high percentage of our podcast.
So yeah. Had you read the book or the?
I read the book like 3 years ago because it.
Oh wow!
It came out in like 2011, and I read it in like 2012.
Mm.
I don't remember where I heard about it. It was like my senior year of high school. Saw it somewhere. Someone in my school had it. I don't know. But it got on my list and I read it. And it followed, from what I can remember, it followed the book fairly closely. With the exception of perhaps near the end, they condensed some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. So the beginning of the book tracked more closely. And then it's almost kind of like they realized, oh, we have this much book left. And only this much movie time left. So let's condense some of the stuff. And the way they did it was fine. And the stuff they condensed probably would have been boring.
Right. I mean,
they could have made it less boring. But if they were going to shrink parts of the book, they shrunk the right parts.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, then still, it was like a 2.5 hour movie, right?
Oh, yeah.
From what I saw. Yeah. So, yeah, it's not like they you know, they got it down to, you know, some 90 minute.
Yeah, no. It's definitely... I think it was like, I don't know. I'm a fan of longer movies. Stuff like Cloud Atlas, which I don't know if you've seen, sticks out in my mind.
I have not seen Cloud Atlas.
It's like a 3 hour movie, just due to the nature of it. And I really enjoyed it. I don't know if I've seen any. And then like you've like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I don't remember how long that movie is, but it definitely has an intermission in the middle and it's quite long.
Well, that was back when they really were trying to be like, this is this is a stage production, but in front of a camera. You know, a lot of the musicals, like Dr. Zhivago, is the same way, and that they it's like a 6-hour movie, and they do have like just 15 minutes of like an intermission title screen. I'm trying to think. I think Sound of Music maybe has the same thing.
Yeah, you probably, yeah. It's been a long time since I've seen that. It wouldn't surprise me. It was definitely from that era.
Well, I'm sure that our two listeners will comment if we're wrong on any of those counts.
How will they comment? I guess they can comment on your subreddit.
Oh, that's yeah. Well, no, I think we should probably spin up a new subreddit for this. But so I want to ask, because I didn't see The Martian because I found the book like a year ago, and I listened to the audiobook because I spend way too much time listening to audiobooks on a certain service, which I will not mention until they start paying us money. But
I
oh
don't.
man. Like as far as their clients go, I've listened to so much stuff. Like there's not a better promo person. But I enjoy it so much that I was really, really kind of terrified to see the movie just because, not that I thought that it wouldn't be good, not that I thought it wouldn't be whatever, but just that when you read a book, you have this particular image of the characters and the layouts of environments and things like that. And I'm like, I just really, really enjoy having this. And despite the fact that knowing I really, really would like to see this movie, I'm just so scared that I won't be able to read the book and, well, listen to the book and hear the same thing again.
Yeah, I mean that's a super legitimate concern. However, I was talking to my boss who I went to go see the movie with, and he was telling me he went back home and just started rereading the book because now he can envision like the scene so much better. So I think that varies by person to person and how much you can draw your own scene in your mind and how much you can build the characters in your mind. Because if you can't do that very well, then having the movie can enhance the book reading purposes. Whereas I certainly see what you're saying is how it can totally detract if you're actually good at world building in your head.
Well, I should clarify, I'm not good at world building. Like most books, I'm like, nope, I don't have much of visualization. I think there's a lot of credit to the narrator for this one. I think it's R.C. Bray. Yeah, I'm remembering it right. I've listened to the book so many times, it's just, but in it, yeah, so like, various fantasy things, I don't have much of a image in my head, but this one I'm just like, oh yeah, Mars. Totally know exactly what that's like.
Yeah, I go there every other week.
Exactly, Well, and how long until that's actually true?
Well, I suppose. I mean, every other week might be stretching it, but I vacation. I do my summer vacation on Mars.
It feels like we've had a bit of a renaissance as far as like big sci-fi movies. We had Gravity, we had Interstellar, and now we've had The Martian. What are like how would you rate The Martian in comparison to those?
So I had this debate recently, and basically what my conclusion came to is that it's really hard to compare Interstellar and The Martian to each other. To me, they're entirely different types of things. It'd be like trying to compare Apollo 13 to 2001: A Space Odyssey. Like
To
that's like
Armageddon.
yeah, exactly. That's like the perfect analogy. We missed Armageddon, but yeah. That's the perfect way of putting it. I personally like Interstellar better. But I there were a lot of those plot holes and stuff that I mentioned earlier that didn't bother me. Like
See, now I'm curious which in that analogy, which movie is 2001? Is that Interstellar or is it
Interstellar. It is
really?
Interstellar. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Weird. I was not a huge fan of Interstellar. I think I had higher expectations for it.
See, I had no expectation. I try to do this with movies. I don't watch trailers or really try to read much about them. My
Well, but you've
circle
got
of
like the title. You've got like, oh, Interstellar. Presumably, there's some interstellar stuff going on, and then you watch, and you're like, you're getting excited. You got your popcorn and your whatever, and it's an hour of corn. It's just cornfields and cornfields and cornfields, and it's a
pipe organ.
It's the cynicism of WALL-E, but without being entertaining for the first hour of the movie.
Yes, I mean, yes, but it was, I don't know, the music was so good that I could just kind of look at the corn and be in awe.
That is a beautiful singing corn right there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The tone of the movie, I think, got to me. I'm a sucker for, you know, the heartful, like, we can do it tone.
Mm.
I don't know.
Well, actually, that was one thing that I found very strange, though, is that really until the end of that movie, you were dealing with such a very, very tiny cast. Like, I don't know if there were just, like, there was, like, an extras strike or something, but it felt like during the entirety of the movie, it's like, oh, wow, these 60 people really want to survive. Like, it feels like you could have, like, they could have given a lot more gravity if they had actually had, you know, anything. But it was such a tiny cast that it's like, okay, it's this, you know, small little offshoot of people trying to survive. And then they go like, oh, yep, we did it. And now we've got billions of people here. But it didn't feel like much of a global crisis because, you know, they kind of restricted it to such a small cast size.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think of that till just now, though. I wish I could remember. There was a movie where I thought that I watched recently, like, wow, that movie had like 6 people in it.
Well, I mean, that could be fine. Like, if you like Clue, you don't need like 100 extras. Like, it really wouldn't enhance the story.
It's true.
And then I guess so. The last one is what did you think about Gravity?
So here's the thing: I haven't seen Gravity.
Oh, all right.
I have not seen Gravity.
I guess we'll have to move on. I'm interested as to how your like I'm willing to suspend my disbelief thing holds up with Gravity, because there's a lot of bad science and Gravity.
Yeah, I remember that. But I've never walked out of a movie having thought, that was a terrible movie that totally couldn't have happened.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, that's fair. I don't think I've ever walked out and really hated a movie. There have been things where I'm just like, you know, in retrospect, eh. on the order of, like, Gravity to me is kind of like the Doctor Who Kill the Moon episode. I'm on the one hand, I'm like, I'm a person who enjoys stories and enjoys, and then there's the other part of me that's like, nope, I can't allow myself to just give this one a pass. It's so wrong and that I have to be indignant about it.
What do you mean a creature eating the moon couldn't increase the mass of the moon? What are you talking about?
Right, Kevin? I don't know. Closest, that's
totally
what?
Logical.
I know. I've even been trying to retcon that. I'm like, is there, like, could it, like, just somehow no. get, like, the solar radiation? Could it somehow pull that in? Is there no...
Well, you know? Yes, but the conversion ratio...
Right, it's like a point mass. Like, yeah, it's a gram heavier, and now the world's destroyed.
Everything is in perfect balance, and then it got 1 gram heavier.
Oh,
we should not have landed that multiple gram rover on the moon. Oops.
Exactly. Oh, man. Actually, that'll be kind of interesting, you know, billions of years from now, that, you know, the one little probe that we put on the moon has completely altered its trajectory.
Well, yeah, that's true enough. I mean, billions of years from now, I think the moon will be, like, off in deep space. It's getting, like, an inch farther away from us every year.
Yeah. I don't entirely understand how that works.
Well, it's not on rails.
Right. Well, yes, I know. So, but the thing to me, though, is that even at that point, there should be like an infinitesimal amount of atmosphere, right? So I'm not sure where
out there.
Yeah. So like I could see it coming in an inch. Like that would at least make sense to me. Like, okay, there are like 2 molecules out there that occasionally hit the moon. This is, you know, but the idea of whatever force it is that's actually pulling it out, I don't know what that is. Is it just?
I actually don't know. It could be like the gravity of Jupiter
Sun. Yeah.
I could imagine, or even like the gravity of the combined, the combined asteroid mass isn't that high and so sparse. I doubt it would be it, but But I could see like Jupiter every so often comes close enough to give it a little bit of an assist.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair. Yeah.
I mean,
we're dealing with N body physics here, which is not
N is a very large number in this case.
Exactly. Well, I mean, not hugely. I mean, the things that actually matter, at least exert enough gravity to have an impact. I mean, it's just kind of the planets, right? And the sun.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, probably. I'd be interested to see how the cumulative effects of the asteroid belt affected things.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably negligible. I mean, obviously, any one asteroid, and they're very, like, people think of the asteroid belt as this very densely thing. Like, if you fly your rocket ship through it, you'll be, like, crashing in 17 times. It's actually extremely sparse.
Right. Well, and presumably, like, the majority of the asteroid belt cancels itself out. Right? If you assume that it's a relatively uniform distribution of heavy things, then it's pulling from, you know, different directions that to some extent cancel each other out. And it's also, it's in the Lagrange point of Jupiter, so it's kind of stable in that sense as well.
That's true. Although you have to think about the Earth-Moon system is in the elliptical orbit around the sun. So how does the moon's position at any one point, is it random? Does it just cancel itself out?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
So yes, Code Monkey Podcast, we talk about lots of code, but mostly space. Yeah, so the idea here is that we're not really just going to talk about, Java bytecode, because that's not, I don't know, maybe not the most exciting podcast type of topic, but yes, we are code people. Alex, do you want to give your credentials?
I have none.
All right, good. So there we go. Clearly, we're both the most qualified people to do this podcast.
I mean, you just graduated. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yes, no, I went back and finally finished up a degree, though not in computer science, but in infotech, which is a different thing. But I was able to wrap that up online because I had dropped out to work. And then finally went back and said, okay, fine. you know, let's finish things up.
Well, I'm still in school. Hence why I don't have any credentials.
I think that's a credential though, right? And you're going to like a good school that teaches more than like, here's a ray tracer in Java.
Yeah, that's true. I'm pretty good school. It's for those of you who are curious, it's Worcester Polytechnic Institute.
See, that even sounds credentialed.
It does have weight in the Northeast. And the farther you get from the Northeast, it's kind of like gravity. It just reduces by the square. And you just eventually, by the time you get to like Iowa, no one has an idea what's going on.
Well, I mean, to be fair, though, like the Northeast, I think, holds a fair amount of weight anywhere in the U.S. I mean, because like until you get to like UC Berkeley, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
I guess UW-Madison is probably the top Midwest.
Cornell.
Well, and Northwestern.
Purdue.
I guess. Yeah.
Isn't there something near Chicago?
Northwestern?
Yeah.
Oh,
there's another.
Yeah, there's
I can't think about it. There's something near Chicago. If you go to school near Chicago and think you'll go to a good school, let us know.
There we go. Outsourcing things so we don't have to Google. Fair enough.
Oh, and backtracking even further, I did think of a credential. I thought of a credential.
Mm-hmm.
What you could term as a very large company decided that I was worth interviewing enough, they're going to fly me across the country in a couple weeks.
Well, there you go. Congrats, man.
So there,
you can fix Google Voice. I mean, yes,
if it was Google, if it was Apple, we could make Apple Voice.
Oh,
and
God,
that would be even better.
Does this bother you as
Except
much as it bothers me?
Service.
This whole, it feels like all these companies are just competing to such an extent that it's just ruining everyone else's experience.
Yes, I do. Because I don't think Google should be in the hardware business, and I don't think Apple should be in the web services business.
What about Amazon? What should Amazon be doing?
Amazon should not make Fire phones, that much is certain.
I'm perfectly fine with them making Fire phones. What I'm not fine with is them restricting a bunch of apps that they release for Android to not work on any other Android device.
I also don't like what they're doing. So recently they started restricting their Amazon store, which is where you should be able to buy anything. And now you can't buy an Apple TV on it.
No, that was just released. What was it, this week at some point?
Yeah,
They took that out, and they took the Chromecast out as well.
yes, I think that was on Friday because the old adage goes bad news on Friday. Everybody forgets about it by Monday. But yeah, that I use Amazon for almost everything I buy if it's not perishable. And that, Amazon does all these weird side products that I, for the most part, just ignore. But this is the first time they've ever done anything with their buying things store that has annoyed me.
Well, I mean, actually, the app itself will not run on my tablet. It just says this is not a compatible Android device. And I'm like, it's a store. Like, this isn't like this, because they had done that with with the Amazon Prime Video stuff. I'd like to watch Game of Thrones, please, or whatever. And I try and watch that on a Nexus device. They go, no, we made this thing for Android. It'll work on all Android devices, but you're not using a Fire thing, so no.
That's ridiculous,
Right, but
Amazon.
it's obnoxious, but I'm like, I sort of get that. But then like the Amazon store, like I want to go here and pay you money to for things. And I know you can't use that here either. And I don't understand how that benefits them, like even from an evil perspective.
I don't know. And the thing is, both Chromecast and now the Apple TV have wonderful development libraries that people in their spare time have hacked together here's an app to run Amazon Prime on your Chromecast or probably now on your Apple TV. And their claim for not having them on the store anymore was that, oh, it doesn't support Prime Video. Well, no duh, it doesn't support Prime Video. You didn't have an engineer spend a few weeks writing it.
Well, I mean, we should be fair. I mean, it's possible that, I mean, both Apple and Google have had a history of restricting certain things from their devices as well. It's entirely possible that Amazon spun up a team, built a whole thing, and then Apple's just like, nope, that's not getting through our store.
I mean, and
And
to
then,
be
I mean,
fair,
I
they.
suppose you could also then say, Google did the same thing. And then Amazon just said, okay, we can't just say we're going to specifically blacklist Apple. We're just gonna have to make this a all competitors thing to be
Yeah.
to be
I
fair.
mean, and to be fair, they probably have copies of those apps ready to deploy if business side says, go ahead. But it was probably a purely business decision.
And I should say, I mean, I did check out a copy of the Fire Stick. Just their response to the Chromecast. And it is fairly nice. And I do believe that it is a hackable type thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's locked or anything like that. As it's definitely been rooted. I've seen the news articles about that. But yeah.
And I gotta say, I really love the Echo a lot. That goes by far like the coolest thing that they've come up with.
Can you have if I were to yell really loudly right now, could I be like
No,
Alexa
I've got headphones. Well,
self-destruct?
I've got headphones and I've got it muted so that I don't accidentally say something and then like, oh, okay.
Wow. I mean, for the most part, I'm not sold on voice activated things yet. They're
Well,
just
this leads
not
us
good
into home
enough.
automation, which I wrote down as a thing as
Yes.
well. I mean, so you've done some home automation stuff.
Yes. So my thing, what I've come to realize about home automation is that for me, home automation works best when you don't think about it. So if you come home and your lights turn on and you don't have to think about it, that's perfect. If you come home and say, you sit down on the couch and say, I want to watch such and such, and it doesn't work, then you might as well have just picked up the remote and clicked through to exactly what you wanted to watch.
Right.
So until like the response accuracy is like 99.9%, it's probably not, it voice activation won't have sold me.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I think there's a threshold, and then the thing is that even when something works 80% of the time, the frustration of it not working means that you're not going to trust the thing in the future. That, you know, yeah. If the last time you tried to turn on your lights and they didn't, you're not going to try that same thing again. I mean, we're conditioned that way. I will say the Echo, it's probably the best as far as accuracy goes. I mean, well, this is something that's curious to me. Like, I don't know what phone you're currently running, but do you do the OK Google or Siri type of stuff?
So I recently just got the new iPhone, which is why I was dealing with all the carrier stuff, and which has the Hey Siri on it, which doesn't usually work from across the room. And I'm peering at my phone sitting on the table, and no, it didn't turn on. I never use it. I'd rather just open up the device and click on what I'm going to do. And that just is normally faster than anything else I'm going to try to do.
Right. I'm curious because I'm sure some people must use, I've had iPhone, I've had Android stuff, and I've played with all of these, but, you know, the idea of Siri, or of just kind of voice activated digital assistants, is a really cool one. Right. If you could say, yeah, oh, remind 100%. Me to do something in 10 minutes, or, you know, I need to get milk from the store, or, you know, what's the current weather or whatever. I mean, that's a useful thing.
Yeah. I mean, you just have to look at Star Trek if you want a good example of why people want voice activated things.
Well, but even then, that computer wasn't always working. You'd think eventually they'd just be like, oh, gosh, you know what? Nope. We're just going to go ahead. Let me just sit down to this console and click through a whole bunch of screens.
Although, to be fair, most of the time that it didn't work, the console didn't work, right, and then it exploded and killed them.
Right.
So consoles were dangerous in the future.
Yeah, well, and people make fun of, Star Wars engineering. Look at how often Star Trek ships just kind of, nope.
I'm sure you've seen the supercut of like Picard saying no to Worf. Have you seen the supercut of Geordi LaForge getting hurt?
Oh God! Oh,
at least half the time. It's just a random console explodes for no reason.
Yeah, it is. I will say, like, I think Star Trek: The Next Generation does probably hold up as well as can be expected. But even so, in retrospect, it's like, wow, that really?
It had its moments.
It really did.
But I would, if you haven't seen it, I would totally recommend going watching Star Trek: The Next Generation. The next time you're looking for something to binge watch, I've binged it at least 3 times.
Oh, wow.
It does hold up.
I grew up kind of watching syndicated episodes here and there, and a few years ago, I did go through and finally watch the whole thing. And I realized, like, yeah, there are only, like, 2 or 3 episodes I hadn't seen. But I was like, this is still, you know, this still works. So, yeah, so the home automation stuff. So what are you actually doing now? Because you had Hue lights and you've had, you know, Raspberry Pi stuff. What have you actually got set up currently?
So currently my home automation stuff does 2 things. I do use Hue bulbs, which are just Wi-Fi controllable bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
I really like those. I put a freeze on buying new ones because I'm going to be moving apartments soon.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're brand new ones that just came out like yesterday or something, that are brighter and have a better color range.
Ooh, are they pulse width?
I don't know. Okay. I can't answer that.
I should just for our listeners who have no idea what we're talking about. So there are kind of 2 ways that lights can change their intensity. One is they can change their intensity, and one is that they can flicker faster and slower, to vastly oversimplify. But one of the problems with some of the Hue bulbs, and you may notice this if you try and take photos, is that what your camera does is it actually takes pixels kind of line by line. It goes, you know, the right to left or left to right, you know, line by line. And the rate at which your camera manages to capture that can be slower than the flicker rate of the LEDs, and so you can end up with very weird distortion and kind of scan lines and problems like that, which both of us doing video stuff, that's frustrating.
Yeah, and I didn't even realize that was the issue until Kevin pointed it out. Because it only happens on my smaller cameras. My point and shoots do that. I never noticed it on my DSLR.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, I think it would depend on. I don't think any of the DSLRs have a single capture. I forget what the word is.
Yeah, I don't know why it was either. Because I did look into that. They are rolling shutters, I think. But I never noticed it on my DSLR. And
Well, I
then,
mean, and it can also matter based on the intensity of the light too. Like
yeah.
if you've got three or four bulbs that are all on full brightness, then you're fine. As soon as
And I
you
think that was probably it. I was going to film, I needed light, I'd turn them all up 100%.
Right.
Yeah.
I tend to go with a kind of a more of a yellowy, incandescent bulb type of look, and that just does not work well with rolling shutter cameras. Obviously, it's more noticeable when you're dealing with video, but you can also get, weird kind of distortion with single stuff as well.
But yeah, so I have the lights. Most of what they do is turn on when I get home, turn off when I go to bed. And then I have a Raspberry Pi driving my sort of home theater. So I use a projector instead of a television just because normally when I have time to watch TV, I have extended periods of time. And so the warm-up cost is worth it for the reduced space and larger screen. And so the Raspberry Pi sends a serial command to the projector, just a little Python script that I threw together one weekend, kicks on that, kick turns on the projector, lowers the screen, and lowers the lights, and then does the reverse when I turn everything off.
Oh, that's cool. So how do you have it like actually raising and lowering the screen? Did you actually rig that up or did you buy
No,
some?
I just bought an electric screen that had a 12 volt trigger on it.
Oh, okay.
So you just pulse 12 volts down it, and it switches. Either goes up or it goes down.
So how do you actually turn on and off the lights when you go to bed? Is it a, what's the actual control interface for that?
It's literally just my watch. So
Oh, are you a smartwatch person?
I am a smartwatch person.
Oh, what kind of smartwatch person?
I have an Apple Watch, as evidenced by the fact I have an iPhone.
How does that how's that working out for you?
I really like it. I don't know why. I have a hard time quantifying why I didn't return it. Because I when I bought it, I was very like, I don't know if I'm going to keep it. I've owned other smartwatches. But I was like, I'm going to try it out. The Apple's really good. You can return like anytime up to a month, I think unofficially, and 14 days guaranteed, no questions. So I'm not super certain why I kept it. What I think it boils down to, and is that it dramatically reduced the amount I pulled my phone out of my pocket. And just that one little thing made me keep it. Now, there are plenty of cheaper, smaller, longer battery life smartwatches that will do the same thing. But I am a fan of integration. I'd like to choose a particular platform and roll it out everywhere. So when I used to run Windows, I ran Windows on everything. When I switched to Linux, I ran Linux on everything. And now that I run OS X, I try to run it on everything. And so I can like open an email and on my watch and be like, oh, I need to respond to this. Pull out my laptop, click the little watch icon that's magically floated up on my laptop, and that exact email I was looking at my watch is now on my computer.
See, I feel like you probably have much better vision than I do because the idea of actually trying to read things on a watch just drives me insane.
Yeah, I'm sure the utility of it will go down as I age.
Fair enough. So I actually have finally settled on a smartwatch myself, which is weird because I thought I had basically just sworn off of them. I played with the Pebble and played with an Android watch. I'd not play with the Apple one. But you know, some of my coworkers have had them, and I looked at them and stuff. And I finally settled on something that is the Withings Activité watch, and it's almost just a watch.
Almost.
Almost. It's got watch hands. It will sync over low power Bluetooth with my phone to keep the time in sync, and then it has an
Oh.
activity monitor. So it'll go ahead and like track my steps, and it will track the amount of sleep that I get. Here's the reason that I was willing to actually, because I just sworn off all of this stuff. But here's the reason I was like, okay, you know what? I'll give this one a shot. Do you know how often I have to charge this thing?
Never.
Never, never, ever.
Does it generate power from you?
No, it's a low power battery, and I have to replace a battery every 6 months, like you would with a watch.
Huh. That's actually really cool.
Right? And well, I mean, so the I mean, obviously there are downsides. It's not running really an OS. It's probably, you know, some microchip.
It's all on die.
Well, I'm sure it's got no. It's if it's, you know, managing the Bluetooth stuff, there's probably some software in there.
Maybe.
But it, you know, and obviously I can't get notifications to the watch. The watch will every so often throw some stuff at my phone, but my phone can never contact the watch. And I gotta say, I really, really like this. This is the thing that kind of bothers me about a lot of the wearable and a lot of the mobile stuff is that, to me, technology should be responsive, and not an interruption. So the idea of I don't necessarily want to, or rather, I should clarify. Like, so like the idea with your TV, if you were to change your Raspberry Pi to just say, always at 8 p.m., turn on the TV, that would be more irritating because maybe 90% of the time, that would be the time you normally watch TV. But the one time when you're like, I've got stuff to do, or like you happen to be searching for stuff underneath where the projector is and it falls on your head, it's a really obnoxious thing, right?
Yes.
So the benefit of kind of this predictive technology is really, really limited because when it's wrong, it's really obnoxious.
The cost is extremely high.
Right. And so like I would there are a couple of situations where I think, okay, maybe this would be useful. Like let me give you an example. If I had if there was some device that whenever I was, you know, at the door would just flash up a warning, you know, take your umbrella. That's probably fine. I can think of very few cases where that becomes a huge problem.
I mean, if it tells you to bring your umbrella on a perfectly sunny day,
Even then, eh. I mean, well, no, I suppose, yeah,
and
that's
you
still
have to
probably
deal with your
irritating.
umbrella all day, I'd get irritated at that pretty quickly.
Well, but even then, I mean, that's the sort of thing where me as a human could make the same problem. So, like, if it were to, you know, if it were to say it's, you know, maybe not take your umbrella, but if it were to say it's probably gonna rain, I can still make the judgment call of whether or not to take the umbrella. And I'm like, okay, this was a nice enhancement to, you know, my day. The idea, though, that I struggle with is that phones and smartwatches decide that a thing happened, you obviously want to know about it right now. There's that predictive
Okay.
technology, and it really, really drives me insane because there are so many times where I am in the middle of a thing. Not for a long time, but you know, I'm on a 20-minute stretch of trying to write, or I'm on a 20-minute stretch of trying to record something or work or whatever it is. And they've decided that somebody tweeted at you, or an email came in for spam, or you know anything, any number of things happened. And what the software is designed to do is to predict that anytime anything happens, you want to know about it, and we should tell you.
Yeah, I mean that is definitely a problem. I have my phone, like my phone buzzes anytime I get an email, and so does my watch. And you have to be very careful about when you turn on muting and when you say "Don't bother me." Turn on the "Do not disturb" mode. And if you're not careful with that, it can cause a lot of problems. Like just before we started recording this, I ran around to all my devices and hit mute, basically.
Well, but this thing is even trying to actively manage that feels like a ridiculously obnoxious job. Like for me, if I were just to try and map out like the times where I'm totally cool with being interrupted and the times where I'm not, I'd have to switch the thing 40, 50 times a day. You know, yeah, for very short bursts. But you know, if if you're in the middle of, you know, like, oh, you know, I need to reply to this email, it's an emergency, and I need to write two paragraphs and I'm in the middle of the first paragraph, it's really important to me that random noises don't start happening, you know, for the next 5 minutes. If they happen minutes later, I'm totally fine.
No, yeah. I mean, and for me personally, that's not an issue. I can normally task context switch pretty quickly. Be like, that's not a new email I need to worry about. Although if I'm at my laptop writing another email, I'd see it in line anyway, and I just know to ignore the notification everywhere else.
Right. Well, yeah, well, that's the other thing, is that notification synchronization is not a solved problem yet.
No, it's not. And that's a huge... Yeah, no, it's not. It's a huge issue sometimes. One of the things I do pretty regularly is I swap my computers around. It's one of my hobbies, I say. I'm usually don't have the same computer for very long. I sell them and buy new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And what that leads to is that sometimes I have like three or four different computers on my desk, and they will all start making the same noise within like a second of each other when I get an email.
Right.
And that can be annoying sometimes.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, if you have three or four devices, then the first push notification is maybe useful at the time that you want to get it, right? So, you know, let's say that 70% of the time you're fine being interrupted. Then it's got a 70% chance of being useful. Well, okay, so it's a 70% chance there. Then we've got to reduce that by the probability that it is something that you care about. So, you know, right. You know, you've got a notification set up for email. It could be you want $1 million. It could be you want $1 million, you know, put some money into this checking account and send us a banker's check, some spammy thing.
And then even then, what's the gain of finding out that you want $1 million right now versus a minute from now?
Right. So, but let's imagine that there's some percentage of things where knowing about that right now is useful to you. So okay. There's 70% of the time, then some percentage of notifications that are actually useful. And if you have a single device, kind of we stop there. As soon as you have multiple devices, now for every event, you have three push notifications. Two of them are spam. I mean, that's exactly what they are. Once you've already received the notification, the subsequent ones are like a recruiter sending follow-up emails. It is just spam. It does not provide utility. On occasion, you may find that there was some notification that you dismissed, and then you see it hours later, and you're like, "Oh yeah, that thing. I meant to write that down or whatever." But that's very, very small.
Yeah,
it's like there's like a Drake equation for the utility
of notifications.
Notifications, exactly.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm curious to know what's the volume of like email and text messages you would get in a day.
Maybe I do not text very much.
Right, or things that would generate notifications, right. Like communications.
Right, so
I should say.
I think one of the biggest things is Slack, to be honest, as far as generating notifications. Because if for whatever reason, you know, I may have stepped away for 5 minutes or whatever, then you know, all of a sudden these things start pushing to my phone, and I don't want to take Slack off of my phone because there are times when I may be out and about and I need to be able to respond to somebody. Emails may be like 50 a day.
Yeah, I'd say that's about where I am. Maybe, probably less than 50, to be honest.
But Slack is the big one. And I think Slack is a very interesting case because, the wonderful thing about the internet is its asynchronicity, right? This is the wonderful thing about text messages and everything. I mean, it's the reason that we stopped calling people and started texting in the first place is that we realized, oh, someone may be busy, I can text them. and then they can respond at a more convenient time, whether that's 2 minutes later or whatever. And now we've got this whole like cultural problem of like people aren't responding to my texts in a reasonable time frame.
And then we have read
I've got
receipts.
the rate exactly. We've added read receipts, which is a big problem because we were trying to socially engineer making this asynchronous tool synchronous.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with things like Slack, in that if somebody, sends me a message, I get a notification. And even then, and even there's no way to actually set up the app as well, so I can just have it there with no, little notification icon or whatever. Like there's no way to set, at least on the desktop, there's no way to actually set it up to be like, if I happen to tab over to it, I can look at stuff. If I don't, it's going to be quiet. We're kind of obsessed with making this wonderfully asynchronous thing very synchronous again, which I think is a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, yeah, I'm not really sure why that is actually.
I mean, I think on the one hand, we've also, I mean, the other wonderful thing about the internet is the immediacy of everything other than people, right?
I suppose that's
You're
true.
watching some movie, you go, who's that actor in the background? It'll take you 5 seconds to check. For our grandparents, it would have taken them 300 years to
They
ask
probably still
everyone
don't
they know.
know.
They still don't know, exactly. There's so much that we can get immediately on the internet. I think that now we're at the point where we really like the I don't have to reply to you right away from our own perspective, but we are really frustrated that everybody else is not as immediately retrievable
Yeah,
as
that's
everything else
true.
on the internet.
I mean, personally, I mean, thinking back on it, if I tweet something that I think is particularly, oh, I like that. I wonder if all my friends like that. I will find myself checking Twitter more often than I would normally do, being like, has anyone
Why didn't
liked it? Has
anybody
anyone?
enjoy my thing? Exactly.
Yes. But like, I laughed at it. Why wouldn't anyone else laugh at it?
It is kind of still that issue of the 90-10 split, where if you're out on a walk in a park, like this is a beautiful day to go outside and whatever, and you get some sort of message that like, oh, there's some sort of emergency thing, and we know that you're reachable, and now we've told you about it, and you've got a read receipt, and now your day is over because you've got to go back and fix that thing. Because unless you're so good, you can't disable all of your notifications and disconnect and disable read receipts and everything in advance every time that I really want to be off the grid for a little bit.
Yeah.
That
I
it
mean,
becomes so hard to actually get off the grid, and then there is sort of a responsibility. If you have received a message and it is marked as urgent, then all of a sudden you're dealing with either I can ignore it and then deal with the guilt and the possible repercussions of them knowing that I've ignored it, or I can give up on whatever else
right.
I was doing and immediately respond to this thing.
Yeah. I mean, or you can play the third option and say, oh, I read it, but I was underwater and couldn't do anything about it. And that's totally believable.